regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
employees. The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hi guys, thanks for coming and sticking around for a second panel. So I'm just going to give a short introduction for our moderator before I hand it over to him to introduce the speakers. So Neil Chilson is a lawyer and computer scientist. He's the senior research fellow for tech and innovation at the Charles Koch Institute, where he works on antitrust, privacy, encryption, and free speech issues. Before joining CKI, he was chief technologist at the FTC and attorney advisor to FTC Chairman Maureen K. Olhausen. So our panel today is going to be focused on speech and the internet. So our title is, should social media platforms be viewpoint neutral and should the government care? So we hear a lot about figures getting kicked off the internet for so-called hate speech. And a lot of people, Congress in general, talk about the political motivations behind censorship and what we're seeing on the internet. So we've put together a pretty diverse panel with a lot of opinions on the topic, and we're really looking forward to it. So with that, I'll hand it over to Mr. Chilson.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody for being here for the second panel, and thanks to Penn Law School for putting this on, and for the Federalist Society, the local chapter, for organizing this. I'm really excited to be here. This is a fascinating topic that I think all of us up here have thought long and hard about, and I know there'll be some great discussion here. As my introducer mentioned, this panel asked two questions. First, what is, or should social media platforms be viewpoint neutral? That's a sort of policy question, like what is the best way for them to treat user content? And then the second one is, should governments care about that? And that's more like, how should governments act if you decide that viewpoint neutrality is something important? So we have a great panel. Those are really hard questions. We have a great panel to help discuss them. And I'll introduce them shortly, but first let me set the stage a little bit. First, a little bit about what this panel isn't about. We're not going to spend a lot of time on whether or not social media platforms are biased against conservatives. That's a factual question. It's a really interesting question, and I think we would all agree if the government is going to do something, it's really important to answer that factual question. But we're at a law school, not a law firm, and so factual questions will leave to others. And I think here we're interested in sort of answering the so what question. So even if they are biased, whether or not they are, what should government do? What is government's role in this space? So maybe we should start with a little bit of background, though. And we're at a Federalist Society event, so what better to start with than the important text of some of the laws that are operating here? So there's two that matter the most to this discussion. The operational parts are very short, so I'll read them verbatim. The first is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And there, the act has two parts that are relevant to the discussion here, and I think we'll get into them quite a lot. But there's Section C1 of the act that says, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information provider. And this basically means that when a user posts something on a social media website, that user can be held responsible for their content, but the social media site itself, if it had no hand in creating said content, can't be held responsible. Section C2 of the Act then says that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be held liable on account of any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. And what this says is that if a website takes down content, doesn't matter whether or not that content is constitutionally protected, they won't be held liable for that. It addresses something called the moderator's dilemma, which is part of what Congress was worried about. That the way the law was working out, essentially, if you took down any content on your site, you were responsible for any content that was left up there. And so they were trying to solve that problem. There's some other operational language in Section C2. I'll skip it for now. The second relevant law that I think probably all of you are quite familiar with at this point is, of course, the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which reads, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of people to peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. So those are the two laws, I think, that are sort of the context for this discussion. And before I introduce the panelists, I have a bit of a confession, first of all. So I personally, as well as my organization, believe that Section 230 is and remains vital to the user-generated content benefits that we have right now from platforms, as well as to U.S. tech leadership. And so given that we'll hear from a lot of skeptical voices today, I cannot and I won't promise to be a perfectly unbiased moderator. And so honestly, I don't think you want that. And I hope by the end of this conversation, you'll see that there's some benefits to having a back and forth, including from a moderator who's not perfectly unbiased.
But we want an unbiased platform.
Yes, I don't know. I guess we'll see. Take whatever lesson you want from
content neutral.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm not going to be content neutral. I will probably be a little bit biased. So with that, let me introduce the panelists. And then after I introduce them, each will make opening remarks. About 10 minutes or so, and then I'll guide some discussion, and then hopefully we'll get questions from all of you. I'm sure we will provoke questions from the smart minds in this room, so I'm looking forward to that. So I will go from my left is Nadine Strossen. She is a professor at the New York Law School. She is the immediate past president of the American Civil Liberties Union. There's a lot here. She's done a ton. She is sort of legendary in the First Amendment and free speech realm. So we're very lucky to have her here to talk about these issues with us. So her left is Adam Kandub. He's a professor at the law school at Michigan State University. He directs its IP, intellectual property, and communications law program. He worked at private firms in D.C., and he was an attorney advisor at the FCC for a long time. He's written extensively on Section 230, so we're very lucky to have him here as well. He's lead counsel on several lawsuits that are involved in this issue, and probably most importantly, he attended Penn Law School, and he plans to continue, I'm going to read this, he plans to continue being a proud alumnus of Penn Law and no other law school. To Adam's left is Carrie Goldberg. She is the founder of the victims' rights law firm, C.A. Goldberg PLLC. This is a Brooklyn firm that does groundbreaking work nationally, fighting for the targets of sexual violence online and off. She worked on a landmark case, Henrik v. Grindr, which I hope she will tell us about today. It's a fascinating case. And she is, and part of that case was to introduce novel legal approaches of product liability law to dangerous tech products. She also worked on a case, KM v. City of New York, which is the highest known recovery in a Title IX case in New York City. She is the author of Nobody's Victim, Fighting Psychos, Stalkers, Purrs, and Trolls, which sounds like a fascinating read. And Carrie attended Vassar College and Brooklyn Law School. To Carrie's left is Arthur Milik.
Yeah, that's right.
Great.
I'm surprised.
He's a research fellow and the associate director of the Heritage Foundation's B. Kenneth Simon Center for American Studies. Milik studies the American political tradition from the founding until today. And his work has appeared in a variety of outlets. And before joining Heritage in 2014, Milik worked for the House Armed Services Committee and at the Hudson Institute. With that, I think I'll work my way down this list in the order here. We'll do alphabetical as well. And so by last name, so Adam, kick us off.
Well, thank you so much for that kind introduction. I am a Penn alumnus, and it's great to be back. And of course, it does bring back a rush of memories, sort of a Proustian moment. And I remember one of my first Federalist Society meetings here. And I remember I knew nothing about it. I remember reading the literature. And it said it was a place for classical liberals, libertarians, and conservatives. And I remember thinking, what do these people have anything to do with each other? They're very, very different. Except, of course, maybe, you know, most people in academia hate them all. But and in general, you know, we come on the same side on things. But I think the issue of free speech on the internet is one that does divide us somewhat, some degree. And my talk is going to mention Section 230, as was advertised. But I want to talk a little bit broader, thinking about themes that bring us together, also that separate us and help us sort of think out sort of puzzle why, you know, sort of the branches of our sort of side of the spectrum, so to speak, have trouble dealing with this question. So we're not going to talk about facts. I mean, we're just going to assume, arguendo, that there is some degree of bias on the internet. And it's interesting how our sort of two branches of our movement, so to speak, take different approaches. And I think both are inadequate in their special ways, and I'm going to sort of suggest that maybe there is sort of a middle path. I mean, we have cognitive biases towards being in the middle. It's not necessarily correct, but at least ways we can think about it together. So the libertarian, classical liberals would say, look, there's bias on the internet, it's not that bad, it will go away with competition, we won't have to worry about it. The market will take care of it. Furthermore, if we get government regulation, it will diminish freedom and will lead to all sorts of inefficiencies. There are some problems with that approach. One is there's the antitrust issue. We really don't know how inefficient, really the effect on the economy of these huge behemoths. I thought it was really interesting. Professor Yu was talking at the last panel about how we need more empirical analyses. Well, you know, we've gone down this road before. DOJ had a Google investigation, you know, about 8-9 years ago, and it was largely inconclusive because these quantities are so difficult to measure. Another problem for the libertarian approach to this problem that we're assuming is existing is the private assumption of government function. Even the most ardent libertarian doesn't want to have, you know, government-run courts or privatized police. Well, maybe they do. I mean, they always sort of shock me what they can say. But generally, we recognize that there's some functions that are governmental because we're concerned about public accountability. We're concerned about market mechanisms sort of undermining a central governmental function. And communications is one of them. Of the few regulatory agencies mentioned in the Constitution, it's the Patent Office and what else, guys?
Post office,
thank you. See, I'm kind of went to a good law school. So, it's a recognition, I think, that by the founders, that a democracy needs some sort of open platform where everybody can come as equals and exchange some way, in a way that sort of recognizes their dignity and allows them to have a role in the discussion. And then there's a deeper, more subtle problem. And that has to do with the nature of the welfare state, the advanced welfare state. Very often, big corporations are a tool of government, and very often government is a tool of big corporations. If you're a libertarian and you really want freedom, is every regulation on big government necessarily going to diminish, on big tech, is it necessarily going to diminish your freedom? I mean, that can't be the right answer when we have these huge organizations that often exist with government. So if you really believe in freedom as your guiding goal, and your attitude will, every regulation has a marginal effect upon that, that can't be right. In a way, we see this actually in Section 230. Section 230 is a statute that I don't think Congress will change, largely because of the interest in Washington, and yet we see the courts pushing it in ways that actually violate the right to contract. That can't be the right answer for a libertarian. I'll just leave it there and move on to, you know, the conservatives' problem. So, you know, the real conservatives who don't, you know, just want to preserve what they feel is the necessary part of our public forum. We don't like the fact that we're being censored, we're being cut out of the discussion, we're having our ability to affect the democracy is being diminished. At a certain level, yes, I mean, we're being the most powerful platforms that speak directly to the young are essentially enforcing, I don't know, a Silicon Valley, I believe, consensus on all of the important cultural issues that we face. But the problem that conservatives face is the solutions. We will see, you know, what was mentioned. One is, you know, current antitrust tools aren't quite up to the task. We know that. The newer ones, behavioral economics, are still in their infancy. We don't know how they're going to reinforce. The DOJ hasn't shown a great ability or even desire to deal with these questions. Well, and furthermore, if we go down the regulatory route, we have things like common carriage and media regulation. And you know, I worked at the FCC. I was thinking about Professor Yu talking about his media regulation experience. Once again, you're facing issues of capture. On the other hand, you know, the question is there sort of a middle ground here? And I think that sometimes the choice is not between the good and the bad, but as Woody Allen would say, the miserable and the horrible. I think that some of the proposals that are being floated in D.C., like for instance, Senator Hawley's proposal to condition Section 230 liability upon a refraining of political censorship or discriminating on the basis of politics makes a lot of sense. I would say that, you know, this is not such an if we're worried about capture, if we're worried about regulatory overreach, you know, the answer should be transparency and simplicity, and that what these reforms in D.C. that are looking at perhaps conditioning Section 230 protection on an agreement, a promise, requirement not to censor on the basis of politics, it is essentially the requirement that telephone companies still work under state regulation. If you want a cell phone or a telephone company, they can't deny it to you because you're a member of the Federalist Society or a Satanist or a Bernie bro. These requirements on our network, on telephones, on telegrams, existed for hundreds of years, and yet somehow our democracy survived and our economy flourished. So I guess in short is, this is a hard question for conservatives, but I think there is an answer with a reasonable regulation based upon hundreds of years of communication regulation.
Thank you. Adam, so Carrie?
Okay, I'm gonna set my alarm.
Yes.
Hi, so before I came here, I was talking to some people in my office, and I was like, what do I say to Federalists? And they said, I've been spoken to a group like this before. Happy to see you all and be here. And you're like, say the thing you say about the government subsidy. And so I'm coming at this issue in Section 230 from the perspective of a plaintiff's lawyer. And as somebody who has clients who have been seriously injured through revenge porn, through child sexual abuse material, through really extreme stalking, through rapes from partnering with people on dating apps. And my clients are having a major issue with just basic access to justice. And I really see that Section 230 is a regulation. Let's not kid ourselves that it's anything but a regulation, which is hindering my clients' access to justice. And their rights under the Seventh Amendment to a jury trial. So I'm going to give you a story about one of my cases, and you know, we were just all at some of us here were at a DOJ event a couple weeks ago, and there was criticism about how the stories that people cite about people about individuals being injured, they're so anecdotal, and we can't really be drawing any conclusions based on these few extreme stories. But the fact is that tort law is anecdotal. It's all about specific incidents of harm. And so we have to be thinking about it anecdotally, because it's these individuals who have been completely barred from access to courts. So back in like the very end of 2016, somebody came to my office, and his body language was just, he just had the life sucked out of him. I hadn't seen a client come to us so hopeless. A lot of, usually when people come to my office, they think that we're the solution. And even if they've been through hell, they're like, okay, now I can get justice. But this man, Matthew, just, he, you know, had tried everything. He'd already, you know, worked with a couple lawyers and gone to the police for his problem, and nobody had helped. And the issue he was dealing with was that he had recently left an abusive relationship with a man, and that man basically decided to dedicate his life to destroy Matthew's. And he did that through the dating app Grindr. He would impersonate Matthew on Grindr using Matthew's pictures, and then match with strangers. And on the profile, it would talk about Matthew's quest for satisfaction of his rape fantasies, and, you know, said that he had drugs to share. And then the offender would direct message with these random guys, and using the geolocating technology on the Grindr app, would send them to Matthew's home and to his job. Like, so this isn't like a cyber stalking situation. These people would come in real life. They'd come, they'd ring his doorbell, they would wait for him in the stairwell at his apartment. On a couple occasions, they followed him into the bathroom at the restaurant where he worked. And it happened as many as 23 times a day that a different person would come in real life. There were over 1,200 visitors, okay? So if he were one of you, there would be somebody waiting outside this door for you to exit this class, thinking that they were here to have consensual sex with you. It was nonstop. And Matthew had gone to the police 10 times. I have the police reports. He'd gotten order of protection against his ex, and nothing was helping. And so when he came to me, you know, I had a little bit of experience by then dealing with tech companies, and I thought I was going to just call up the general counsel at Grindr and tell them you have to permanently exclude this user and everything would be fine. But they completely ignored my cease and desist letter, which, you know, as like a lawyer, it's like I was in it with Matthew, because they'd also ignored the 50 times he had flagged the different accounts. And there were multiple accounts. So then the next step is we got a state court to issue a restraining order against Grindr. And our papers were very specific. We weren't holding Grindr accountable for any of the content of these profiles. Okay, so we weren't holding them accountable for harassment or any of the words that his ex was using, because we knew about Section 230. We knew that Grindr would plead that they were immune from liability for third-party content if we made any of those pleadings. And so instead we basically, you know, said that they were violating their own terms of service, which enables them to remove users, and they clearly weren't. When we finally got them to come to court, their lawyer said that they didn't actually have the technology to exclude an abusive user. And then we had like this eureka moment where we're like, this is a products liability case. Like, it is so foreseeable that if you have brought to market a dating app that relies on geolocating people and face-to-face encounters, then and you haven't built into it like a way to ban abusive users, because it's just so foreseeable that rapists and child predators and stalkers are going to sometimes use that product. Then you've created a dangerous product, and we basically said that this was a defectively designed product, and we thought that this was like the key to getting around Section 230, because we weren't suing them for any of the content of this user. The judge thought we were fools. She dismissed it on a 12B6 motion, so you've done federal procedure. So that's like really early. That's a really early stage. It's before discovery. Grindr didn't even have to plead. They didn't even plead that they were immune from liability. They didn't have to plead that they were an interactive computer service, that we were suing them for a publication tour, and that we were suing them for third-party content, which are the three prongs of Section 230. They didn't have to do anything. The judge just, I joke about this, just was basically playing computer scientist and said, okay, that you know she had authority without even needing pleadings to absolve this company of any liability. We took it to the Second Circuit. They also thought, you know, that they stuck with the lower court's decision, and we petitioned the Supreme Court to hear it. Because to us, you know, we're talking about content moderation. We're talking here today about, you know, platforms and their biases, and perhaps, you know, being a little too aggressive in removing content. But, you know, here's a situation, and there are others like it, where, you know, there's really extreme, like, life-altering abuses that happen on these platforms. And even in those cases, these really extreme cases, these companies are saying that they're not liable. And they're actually pointing to Section 230 as creating the standard of care that means that they don't have to be liable. So they have a direct, I mean, they're disincentivized from moderating their content because they say, you know, we don't have to, and by not moderating it, we're just complying with our rights under Section 230. So, you know, when people were pushing for Section 230, under this belief that, you know, it would free up these internet companies to do this, to do all this responsible content moderation, and they wouldn't be liable for any of those decisions. But what's actually happening is like the perverse opposite, where they're seeing this as sort of a cover to not have to moderate content at all, and not have to go to court. And so, and, you know, I want you to just think about Section 230 as a government subsidy, because it is so extreme, like really extreme in this country, for an entire industry to be immune from liability, to be basically outside the reach of the courts. I mean, the only thing that comes close are like, is the gun industry. But even with guns, if, you know, the gun company might not be liable for somebody that gets shot, but they would be liable if the object itself malfunctioned and exploded in your face.
Just doing it right now.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Product liability.
And so it's, you know, at this point, we have the most powerful, data-rich, omniscient industry that has grown into, like, just such a behemoth. They just don't deserve to be outside the reaches of our courts. Like, the one thing that equalizes all of us and equalizes us against these big companies is the right to hold accountable somebody that has injured us. And so what happens when we don't have that right, and these companies are just growing richer and richer day by day, minting money, but also minting our personal information, our data, our consumer habits. It's really, I think Section 230 is extremely dangerous. I feel that the reform shouldn't just be about conditioning liability on content moderation habits, but I think it needs to go. I think tort law for centuries has done the job. And we've got Iqbal and Twombly, which creates really high standards for pleadings. And so you're not gonna get a lot of BS. I mean, BS cases. You'll get some, but not
for,
but I mean, it costs a lot of money to sue. You're already gonna get BS cases from people that don't even know about Section 230. You know, like they're already bringing Section 230 cases for bogus reasons. And the last thing I wanted to say is lost my train of thought. I'm gonna leave it at that.
Yeah, we have plenty of
I've done my 10 minutes. Go.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Arthur.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me and for coming here today. I think it's not an exaggeration to say that there is a multi-part front unifying to crush the freedom of speech in America. Public opinion support, public opinion polls support this, and the entities that are doing this are very strong. The universities since the 60s have begun to have a new teaching on the freedom of speech. And there are at least two generations of young people who opinion polls confirm want to limit the freedom of speech. Also, we are constantly pressured by other nations, and especially by the UN, to circumscribe our understanding of what speech is and is not permissible. And then there's big tech, which has become, whether you like it or not, the public forum for deliberation, both political and non-political. The question is, where does this go? And what can we kind of predict and think through of what might occur given this enormous front? I'm not a lawyer. I do political theory. And so my goal is to take a step back and think through what hate speech actually means. I think it's a misnomer. It gives you the impression that, well, those that want to criminalize or outlaw hate speech, they want to get rid of hatred as such. Or what they want to do is get rid of all hate speech. But that's not true. It has to do, as I'll explain in just a second, with the logic of oppressor and victimizer, and victim, excuse me, that the oppressor's speech should be reduced and maybe taken away, and that victims, the marginalized, should have free rein to speak. And I think that this is a very dangerous situation. For that reason, hate speech has really very little to do with racial epithets. It has something to do with that, but not much. It has not that much to do with Holocaust denial either. Those are kind of the public presentation of what hate speech is, but I think that there's an entire theory beneath it, and I want to explain some of it to you. It's worth reminding ourselves why we even have the freedom of speech at all. I know that this sounds, you know, a little lame and stale. You guys are all in law schools, but there are philosophic reasons that we have it that support the continuing character of our regime. The first one is that your speech belongs to yourself because your mind belongs to yourself. It's yours. And the highest use of that mind is the pursuit of the truth. That's from the kind of Enlightenment tradition and our founders. The second reason is the most obvious one that you guys already know, and that is for self-government. You cannot have self-government. A free people cannot rule itself unless there is genuine public deliberations on the common good. And this new hate speech regime, as I'm going to argue, undermines that that understanding. And the third, which is my favorite, is how the freedom of speech affects our character. So I'm from Russia. I was born there. And there isn't really the freedom of speech there. And you see it reflected in the nature of or in the character of the people. They're not used to having this need to persuade other rational beings to their side, to make arguments. I mean, this is what we learn in seminar rooms. You guys are nodding along, I suspect. Maybe you're Russian and you've seen this. On the other hand, it develops in us, the freedom of speech develops in us, this capacity to be persuaded. And that is such a delicate, rare thing that blooms once in a while and can disappear. And that's that kind of character of the public is what we're fighting to preserve in this speech regime. We are basically the last holdout in the Western world from restricting those who speak hate, as they like to say. All of Western Europe has banned it, and they have these vague formulations, a lot of which I've learned from Nadine Strossen, who is a hero of this cause. The law says that they would like to prevent the incitement of hatred. In other words, not the incitement of violence, but the incitement of hatred. And they go so far as to say that they claim that, I'm quoting the law, hate speech can also be concealed in statements which at first glance may seem to be rational or normal. So what kind of speech are we talking about? The kind that you kind of already have a grasp of. Speech that's deemed racist, anti-trans, homophobic, xenophobic, anti-religious. In Belgium, it includes sexist speech. And the law says speech or any speech or gesture intended to express contempt. In other words, contempt is criminalized. What are the punishments? Well, there are fines, obviously. Homes have been raided, arrests have been made. Lives have been destroyed through lawsuits, even when they are not convicted. A Belgian politician was banned for 10 years from serving, from being in public service. Canada, too, has these laws. And you'd think that maybe, well, you know, maybe these laws would work. Maybe they would stop hatred. I mean, they are draconian. But the truth is they don't. So I'm Jewish, and if you're Jewish and you live in the UK, you're 13 times more likely to be the victim of violent crime as a Jew than in America, even though anti-Semitic speech is criminalized. These European societies are full of discrimination. It simply doesn't get at the thing that defenders claim it will get at. Now, you may look at America and say, well, things are great here. We have the Mittal v. Tom decision. We're safe. And it was unanimous. You'd be wrong to think that. Not only is this front building, as I've said, this multifaceted front, but there are some precedents already in the law that will be used exactly for this purpose. The two I have in mind are, one, I'll get into this in a second, but you guys should track the use of the word dignity in the sexual liberation cases. There you'll see, culminating in Obergefell, there you'll see this use of dignity that says basically you have the right to create your own identity and others must respect that identity. That is one step away from, and the law can demand that others respect it, that identity, and that your speech will harm that identity. The other obvious place is in anti-discrimination laws. The EEOC already has some regulations that say that certain kinds of speech in workplaces are violations of anti-discrimination laws. Those two legal paths will be pursued, I think, in the future. So leaving behind Canada, Europe, and our kind of bubbling up legal regime, I want to lay out very quickly the theory behind hate speech. And I think that the theory that I'm going to lay out is broadly subscribed to by Twitter, Google, and Facebook, although Facebook is a little more ambiguous. But this is the logic when you look at the specific wording, which changes, you know, from time to time. But the logic is what I'm going to explain to you. And this comes from basically the kind of critical race theory professors who developed it. In other words, when big tech says that they have neutral policies, that's a public claim. In reality, they follow the logic that I'm about to lay out. And here's what it is. There are three parts to it. First is that hate speech causes physical harm. Okay, what kind? Well, high blood pressure, strokes, you name it. Any kind of, there will always be a social scientist that comes along and allegedly proves this. So that's the first claim, that you become ill from hearing hate speech. Is that for me?
No.
Okay. You have 2 minutes, actually.
2 minutes, okay. The second is that it excludes people from politics. In other words, people do not feel welcome or even celebrated. And you may think that, well, everybody has voting rights, everybody has civil rights. What's the problem if somebody dislikes you? Well, the problem is that here's how the theory goes, that if you are a marginalized group, there is no reasoning with the majority. The majority's interests are so deeply tied to their power that they cannot hear the good reasons that the oppressed or the marginalized offer to them. The third claim, I'm running out of time, but the third claim is this idea of dignity. Everybody likes dignity. Everybody's like, oh, this is a beautiful, highfalutin term, but it has a very specific meaning. We used to have a tradition in America, well, two traditions. One is that you have dignity because you have a soul. We get that from the Judeo-Christian tradition. The other understanding of dignity is the natural rights understanding, which is that you have dignity insofar as you have forethought, You have reason, you have forethought, and therefore you can be held accountable for your actions. You're a moral actor. But this new view of dignity is different. It comes from a guy named Charles Taylor, but not only him. And the basic idea is that everybody has, I'm quoting him, everybody has the potential for forming and defining their own identity. Okay, so the idea is this, that you have been, if you are a marginalized group, you have been given a false identity by the alleged oppressor group, who in America, I don't blush to say because I'm quoting them, is the white majority. They all say this outright, all of the kind of thinkers on this. They have given you a false identity, and you have to liberate yourself from that false identity and create a new identity. And for you to have full dignity, for you to have full dignity, your identity must be respected by that oppressor as you respect yourself. And hate speech undermines that self-respect. Make sense? So everybody, all of the Rainbow Coalition of the marginalized are allowed to have an identity, perfectly free speech, except the oppressor group, who needs to be quiet because their identity itself is oppressive to the marginalized. And so what you have then in this new hate speech regime is a one-way street. The marginalized must not only speak up, but must speak out and undermine the power structures and the identity of the so-called oppressor. And then the oppressor group must sit down and be quiet. And I'll make one last point. This is the most important aspect in my mind, that under this new hate speech regime, factual claims can be considered hate speech. So here's an example. Speaking about affirmative action, that can be hate speech because it harms the marginalized self-respect. Speaking about immigration, legal or illegal, harms the self-respect of our immigrant communities. Defending traditional views of the family and marriage also harms the dignity of the marginalized. Even dog whistles, things that seem to be totally neutral, like welfare policy, could also be considered hate speech. And so what you have in this hate speech regime is a total circumscribing of the political issues that a free people can discuss. And they're not a free people anymore. They can't rule themselves. These issues are unavailable to them. And one last thing, what you cannot also question are factual claims about the narratives, we like to say, or the mythologies is a better word, that the marginalized create for themselves. One cannot speak against those, even if they're factually correct. Like, for example, you guys saw the New York Times 1619 project. It's riddled with all sorts of errors. But in a hate speech regime, scholars who disagree on the facts, I think, could not actually dispute these things in public because this is a narrative, this is a sacred narrative of an oppressed, marginalized people.
Thanks, Arthur.
Thank you.
Professor Stresson?
Wow. So I'm glad that I'm going last because my thought was this is such a huge topic that we have for this panel. I'll try to comment on what my co-panelists have said, but the scope has been so broad. Let me just say, Carrie, I have spoken at Federalist Society events many, many times, and I'm not going to say despite the fact that I am a bleeding heart liberal, but I think because of that fact, and I have saluted this organization, I'm still quoted in the first opening page of the Student Federalist Society brochure. Who's counting? Justice Scalia is only on the next page. Way back when there was no other organization that was airing opportunities for discussion and debate about these really pressing issues of constitutional law, civil liberties, human rights. The Federalist Society has done it and has always, judging by the number of times I'm invited, welcomed an array of perspectives. So I really thank you for that. But in the recent past, I have to say that the greatest contribution you've made is spurring the formation of the American Constitution Society. Okay, this is such a huge issue, and I do come into it with a focus on, my Cato Institute edition of the Constitution of the First Amendment. I am not nearly the expert on Section 230 that Carrie and Adam are, so I don't know the details of the litigation, including your litigation, which I really enjoyed hearing about and look forward to learning more about. But I will say this, from having read background information about Section 230, having read litigation papers of my colleagues at EFF, Human Rights Watch, Electronic Frontier Foundation, Human Rights Watch, other organizations that are bringing a constitutional challenge to a cutback on Section 230 that had the most wonderful aims that I completely share, namely reducing sex trafficking of women and children. This was a statute called Foster or SESTA, that it has had unintended adverse consequences that have redounded to the detriment of precisely the groups, the vulnerable groups that were intended to be protected. And from having read legislative testimony, I have absolutely no doubt that the major beneficiaries of Section 230, again, in general, and maybe it's been enforced in way, and I have read claims from, among others, Danielle Citron, whose work I admire a great deal. I've read claims that it has been enforced in ways that went beyond the original intention, and I'm agnostic about that, and I'd really love to hear what you have to say about that, Neil. But as written, the major beneficiaries are intended to be, and I have no doubt are, not the internet companies themselves, but the users. What would have been at stake if we had an internet that was subject to live social media companies and other intermediaries and platforms that were subject to just the incalculable liability that they would face if they were held accountable for what is posted by third parties? We would have had the same narrow, strict gatekeepers that we have on the traditional media. And it would have completely deprived the internet of its liberating and equalizing function, promoting freedom of speech opportunities that are most important precisely for those who have traditionally been marginalized and not had access to the rest of the world, government officials and fellow activists and associations. Now, we live in a society where the pendulum tends to swing from one extreme to another, and we went from irrational exuberance, to pick a phrase from another context, about the potential of social media to, I think, the tech lash, which has gone too much in the opposite direction. But I really have to remind people, you know, who share my commitment to social justice and human rights, for women's rights, children, all of those who are most marginalized and vulnerable, that these groups had the most to gain from having access to a platform that was not subject to gatekeeper restrictions. How many people know that the Me Too movement actually was founded in 2006, but we never heard about it until a couple years ago when it had the power of social media companies to amplify it? How many people know that the Black Lives Matter movement was initiated even earlier than that? But again, we never heard about it until it gained traction through social media, able to disseminate the message very widely. So I am definitely very concerned about and aware of the harm that speech can do. I completely agree with the Supreme Court when it explained in Snyder versus Phelps, the case in which it upheld freedom to engage in extremely upsetting, offensive speech by the Westboro Baptist Church, which was insulting everybody who's not a member of the church, including Catholics and members of the military and LGBTQ people and racial minorities, you name it. I think, you know, everybody, whether you're conservative or libertarian or everything else, is going to be insulted by some of the vile speech that that group engaged in. And yet the United States Supreme Court said, we are protecting that speech not because we are not cognizant of the harm that the speech can do. Speech is very powerful. It has power to do a great deal of good as well as a great deal of harm. And more harm is done by giving power to the government, or I would add to powerful social media companies, to exercise what is inherently unfettered discretion to pick and choose, as Arthur says, what is hate speech for one person is love speech for another. By the way, the Westboro Baptist Church itself, I recently read Megan Phelps Roper's, you know, just absolutely fascinating memoir about leaving that church in which she had been brought up. And as you know from having read the opinion and followed the news, the website and the philosophy of this group is www.godhatesbags.org. But as Megan very convincingly and sincerely explains, they're saying that God hates fags, not that they do. To the contrary, her view when she was in the church was exactly the opposite. We're the only ones who love these people. We're trying to save their souls. They're going to burn in everlasting hell and damnation. And so what we have is love. So that's just, to me, a very dramatic example of how inherently subjective that concept is. And the same thing when you look at all of the other controversial content that people are seeking to impose some limits online. And I know because I'm constantly coming to the defense of the most controversial speech, not defending it substantively, but defending the neutral principle of freedom of speech, which I think is especially important to those who have traditionally been discriminated against and marginalized. But you have to do it in the context where it's attacked. And the most controversial kinds of speech that everybody wants to censor are hate speech, terrorist speech, and disinformation. And the same problems that Arthur laid out and that I've added to about the inherent subjectivity of the concept of hate speech, that's also true about disinformation, right? Some people think that everything that's in the New York Times is disinformation. Other people feel that way about Fox News and so forth. And the same thing about terrorist speech. There's the old statement that one person's terrorist is somebody else's freedom fighter. So for me, the question is, what is the lesser of two evils? Whom do I distrust more to make these basic decisions about which ideas we should be exposed to and which not? And when it comes to the government, we have a long track record, I think, of and it's a predictable one, which is replicated by the powerful social media companies, that they are over time disproportionately going to exercise their discretion in a way that is friendly to the powers that be, the status quo. And so I'm fascinated to hear theories that conservative speech is being systematically discriminated against on the social media companies. I'm here to tell you that human rights groups, you know, on the left end of the political spectrum have been complaining forever about what is seen to be unjustified suppression of our messages. And I say our because the ACLU has been in a large coalition of almost 80 civil liberties, civil rights, and human rights groups that have been complaining to Facebook and others that speech that is protesting discrimination, that is protesting police abuse, that is protesting pipelines and, you know, just exercising freedom of speech to seek to challenge the status quo has been disproportionately suppressed. Last spring, there was an article in USA Today that summarized this problem with the following headline, Facebooking While Black, subtitle, Activists Call It Getting Zucked. And there have been so many anecdotal reports about that kind of suppression, that when people try to call out hate speech or when they try to seek support for those who are disparaged by it, that is treated by the moderators or by the algorithms as hate speech itself. Last summer, there were two studies, that very systematic scientific studies that came out about algorithms in social media, specifically focusing on Black Americans and so-called Black English. And these were two teams of researchers from multiple universities in the United States and other countries, did very reputable in-depth analyses that were reported at a very prestigious conference of an organization I had never heard of before, a field I'd never heard of before, called the Association for Computational Linguistics. And their analysis showed that Black speakers online were 1.5 times more likely to have the same expression treated as hate speech than if it was another speaker. And if the expression was in Black English, quote unquote, it was more than 2.2 times more likely to be censored. All of this, I think, is, and I'm not disputing that there's not other kinds of bias that creep in. It's inevitable, whether you're talking about a human being or an algorithm that's been programmed by a human being. There is no objective way to enforce these so-called standards, content moderation standards. I last summer testified in Congress a hearing on whether the social media companies are doing enough to protect us against hate speech, terrorism speech, and disinformation, the big three. And the other witnesses were from Google, Facebook, and Twitter, and I was there to talk about free speech. And I will tell you this, every single member of that committee, Democrat and Republican, agreed on 2 points. Number one, the social media companies are allowing too much of this kind of speech and not enough of that kind of speech. And obviously, they disagreed radically as to what was this and what was that. So, you know, from a civil liberties perspective, a human rights perspective, the ideal situation that I would like to see is that these companies would adhere to the same speech protective standards that the government is required to adhere to as a matter of First Amendment law. There's another source of law here. I've lately taken to carrying around the international, this is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights. Article 19 is the free speech protection, and I've recently become aware of the fact that I'm really trying to propagandize as much as possible, propagate as much as possible, which is that the UN bodies that have the power to authoritatively interpret Article 19 and Article 20 and other UN treaty provisions that deal with free speech have in fact interpreted them in a very speech protective way. Unlike the way the European Court of Human Rights and the way domestic courts around the world, as Arthur alluded to, have very restrictively interpreted free speech, it's not as well known as it should be that the UN treaty bodies are very close to the United States in interpretation so far. So David Kaye, who's a law professor who is serving as the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Speech, starting a couple of years ago, he has been really pounding the idea that these companies ought to voluntarily adhere to those international speech protective standards consistent with the guidelines that were adopted by the UN in 2011, calling on major business companies to voluntarily adhere to human rights standards. It's a lot more persuasive than asking them to adhere to the First Amendment. The United States is consistently described as being an exceptionalist in terms of our protection of free speech. But I'm really thrilled to learn the extent to which this international document, which has been ratified by 173 out of 195 countries in the world, has been interpreted in a very speech protective way.
It's been a great set of comments. The thing that jumped out to me, and maybe the way I'd kick off the conversation, and we I think we ended 2:30, 2:55, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we have about 20 minutes, so maybe we'll have about 10 minutes of discussion on the panels here between the panelists, and then I'll hope to get a couple questions from the audience. So that might mean we only have time for kind of one other round, where you guys are very quick. But what jumped out to me on this is, Professor Strassen, you made the point quite well that people really disagree on what standards might be applied in this space. And so the question to me is, you know, we might want to something like the First Amendment, but sort of the motivating factor for Section 230 was that the First Amendment allows a lot of things that a lot of people don't want to see on Facebook, for example, and that these companies might not want a lot of interest. They don't have a lot of business interest in allowing up. And then on top of that, the other thing that made me think is that, you know, there was a little bit of mention in the previous panel about the fairness doctrine, which was a sort of neutrality requirement for broadcasters. And it was enforced by the FCC, but it was, it's pretty well documented, was quite abused by politicians to get, especially against conservative speech on websites. So you talked a lot about the interest groups, the marginalized groups that were able to, in the social media world, come out. There was a similar example in the broadcast era where the fairness doctrine was used essentially to suppress a lot of controversial speech, I would say. It's non-mainstream and in enforcement that often meant sort of conservative speech. That's part of why Reagan got rid of it. And so my question is, for I think people who would like to modify 230, who are thinking about that approach, how would you take these very different views of what speech should be okay on the internet and put that into a law in a way that makes any sense and that's able to be enforced by an agency and also not going to be abused by politicians and then also consistent with the First Amendment? It's a big challenge, so I'm sure we can solve it in 10 minutes. Who wants to jump in? Yes.
Actually, a lot of this has to do with, you know, Section 230 and just understanding the basics that get very confused very quickly. If I had a bookstore, if I had a newspaper, I'm liable for all the content that's in there.
That's not true.
Hold on one second. I mean, as basic rule, yes, if I've got a newspaper, I'm liable for the advertisements. The idea is that people who are harmed have a right of redress. That's basic common law. Now, we have relaxed that on the internet, so that, you know, if Facebook is not liable for the terrible things that Professor Strassen says about me on our Facebook page. And we like that, because as Mr. Strassen says, there's lots of people get to talk. But what the problem has been with Section 230 is that they have used it to immunize them, as pointed out here, from their contractual promises to other people. They've used it to immunize them for their decisions to censor, which are violations of contract law, nothing to do with libel. They've used it to immunize it actually against antitrust claims. So obviously, they've used it to immunize, as you pointed out, their speech codes, which are very, very restrictive and often hurt conservatives. So, you know, obviously, Section 31 just protect third-party content, that's fine. But it's been used and expanded by courts, particularly California, to protect things that shouldn't be protected, like the speech codes. And the founder of the Fairness Doctrine, yes, I agree with you. The history of media regulation is one of discomforting closeness between government and regulated parties. But that's really a red herring. I mean, the Fairness Doctrine was about broadcasters, you know, radios and television. We got over the air. I don't know if anyone does that anymore. But they were required to put both sides' controversial views on the air, and as a result, they just didn't have very much controversial political programming. But that was a very burdensome regulation because it affected the broadcaster's ability to have any opinion whatsoever. Nothing in Section 230 or any of the revisions have anything to do with that. You know, Zuckerberg and Dorsey are free to talk as much as they want on their platform. It has nothing to do with limiting their speech in the same as the Fairness Doctrine did. They can talk all they want. So that's
our choice. The analogy that strikes me as the closest, which you haven't mentioned, is landline telephones, right? We don't make the telephone companies liable for the speech of those of us who are using that conduit. And again, one has to ask, would the consequences be of imposing greater liability on these companies? It would completely diminish the positive potential.
We granted the telephone companies as part of an ancient common carriage deal in which they can't discriminate on the basis of politics, in which they have all sorts of public interest requirements to serve the community in general, and it's been part of a long deal.
Which you have argued is a great deal and is one that should be applied to the industry.
Well, I mean, I think we had to start thinking about
it. And it also granted them a monopoly that was quite sustained for 40 plus years. And so we got to think about whether or not that's a good trade-off as well.
Well, sometimes it wasn't granted. I mean, non-monopolistic telephone companies and telegraph companies still had it. So I think that there's a connection there.
We're running up on time, so I want to give...
We have to think about what these companies' real product is. It's us. It's our information. These companies aren't really here. They might say they are but they're not here to facilitate ideas. They're here to sell advertising, to advertise at us, and to collect our data and monetize that. And so it's really, I think, fundamentally different from phone companies. But I mean, I have a very just modest wish that. For Section 230 reform, which is for it to exclude dangerous conduct that is harming people. And let's remember, Section 230 is, removal of it is not an issue of speech. It's about the right to sue for harms. So if you're going to sue a tech company, you have to actually have the harm. You have to have all the elements of a tort in order for it to even survive. But, I mean, we can't even get injunctive relief against companies. If you have an order saying that, this company needs to remove the naked pictures off of their site, Facebook doesn't have to honor that. And there's law that says that. Hassel v. Byrd says that they don't have to honor court orders to remove content. And number one, you can't sue these companies to remove it because of Section 230, but you also can't get an order without them being named as a defendant, because that would be a due process violation. And so we really are powerless. But I think that there needs to be injunctive relief. There shouldn't be any immunity for representations made in terms of services, those are illusory. Companies don't have to abide by their terms of service because they can't be held liable for not. Section 230 immunity needs to be an affirmative defense, and it should only apply to publication torts, like it was originally intended to back in 1996, talking about defamation and obscenity. It's my fix.
Arthur, before I jump back in.
No, this is a legal question. I don't excel in this world.
Well, maybe I'll pitch that to you then. Opening up these companies to being sued to take down any content with injunctive relief in an era of activist, adventurous attorneys who might want to shape content that's on these platforms and maybe take down hate speech, for example. Could you see any challenges with that?
This is for me?
Yeah.
I don't have an answer, basically, but here's what matters to me, and I sort of said this in my remarks, that the internet has become the public square, and you need a public square to rule yourselves. If you want to remain a free people that actually deliberates on your future, on the policies that affect your future, there has to be the freedom of speech. And when you look at the kind of several companies that control, an overwhelming share of the space where the freedom of speech takes place, and you see that there's a trend, like the one that I described, where the logic follows the logic of hate speech and what kind of speech will be restricted. This, to me, is a very alarming thing. So I have no comments on the legal issue, but...
Yeah, maybe I'll open it up to questions with I think the point I was inarticulately trying to get across is that Section 230 in some ways is what lets these platforms leave content up when they're facing lawsuit pressure to take something down. And so that can be harmful. That can also be a big benefit to people who have minority positions. And so there is a real trade-off here in imposing liability, not for what they said. Under Section 230, platforms are liable for things that they say, in part. They're also liable for things that they do. So I'm a little curious about not being able to sue them, especially since when I was at the FTC, we sued these platforms for violating their terms of service all the time. Anyways, I'll stop there. I want to hear from you guys. Questions? Yeah.
Hey, so I feel like 230 is being a little simplified here.
Oh, sure.
The idea that we want platforms to be able to take down porn, right? We want to be able to go to Twitter and not be barraged with, like,